from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, Thursday marked the one-year anniversary of the passage of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. What has it accomplished and what remains with the majority of regulations yet to come? We'll get in-depth analysis in the hour ahead. We'll include your calls, emails, and online questions and comments. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. 3 years ago, the nation barely escaped another Great Depression, and the mortgage meltdown and financial crisis led to the passage a year ago this past Thursday of the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Law, known as the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, engineered by former Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd and Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank, both Democrats. Officials from both the Security and Exchange Commission and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission have written dozens of rules required by the law, with many, many more to come. And with Thursday's one-year milestone in mind, we explore the effects and the future of Dodd-Frank. Joining us from Washington this morning is Katie North. She's Senior Finance Policy Analyst for Bloomberg Government, and we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Thank you for being with us. Scott Talbot is with us in studio. He's Senior Vice President for Government Affairs. He will be with us shortly. Here in studio with us is Eric Talley, who's Professor and Gilbert Foundation Chair in Law, Business, and the Economy for UC Berkeley School of Law at Bolt Hall. Welcome, Eric Talley.
Happy to be here, Michael.
Happy to have you here. And let's begin, Katie North, with you. I was looking at the progress report that was put out by Davis Polk and Wardell LLP. Overall regulations, well, they've completed 13% of all the rulemaking requirements. Does that mean that we are making the kind of progress we should be making, or does that mean there's a lot more to be done? It seems like 13% is not a high percent.
It's a bit of a mixed bag, Michael. You know, there's been quite a few of these regulations that have met their deadlines on time, but then there's a whole set of other regulations related to credit risk retention, some of the rules on the debit interchange that we saw that were delayed, and some of the effective dates have been delayed. But overall, about 60 rules of well over 300 that have to be finalized under Dodd-Frank have actually been completed. And then the level varies as to those proposed rules and those that have been finalized as to what those effective dates are.
And there's a lot of resistance to those regulations, as we'll find out in the course of this hour, and there's fighting about future regulations. But a lot of it boils down to, it seems, partisan politics. The sense from the Democrats are that the banks are too big, derivative markets are still untamed, and regulations are going too slow, and the Republicans are saying regulations have gone overboard.
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion in Congress in the past year of trying to repeal the law, trying to look at specific provisions and pare it down or repeal it altogether. But actually, last week is the only time we've seen any sort of legislative activity happen as a standalone bill on the House floor, when there was a bill, H.R. 1315, that passed the House that would kind of limit some of the CFPB powers, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and actually replace it with a five-member commission rather than a single director as it stands now under Dodd-Frank.
The goal was to make consumers safer under Dodd-Frank. How much have we really moved in that direction, or how much have we accomplished in that?
A lot of those regulations haven't been finalized. In fact, the anniversary of Dodd-Frank last Thursday marked the transfer date of those powers to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And it means that that entity will be in charge of enforcement going forward. But a lot of any kind of new rules haven't been proposed or completed at this time.
We're talking again with Katie North. She's with us from the nation's capital. She's Senior Finance Policy Analyst for Bloomberg Government. And you know, a lot of this was, at least Dodd-Frank, was an attempt to deal with too big to fail and do it by tightening capital requirements and suspending the largest financial firms. I was noticing that right now the top 10 banks hold 77% of domestic assets. So that's compared, by the way, to 55% in 2002, meaning too big to fail is even bigger.
Yeah, you know, these too big to fail firms, these top 10 banks, were actually able to use the crisis as a little bit of a catalyst to grow bigger. You'll remember in 2008, Wells Fargo purchased Wachovia, Bank of America took on Countrywide Financial. They were able to take care of some almost like fire sale prices to grow larger as a result of the crisis. And Dodd-Frank sort of splits things up as far as regulation goes, and I like to express it in terms of what regulators can do during normal times and what regulators can do during a time of future crisis. And a lot of what regulators will be doing during normal times now is gaining a lot more information from the financial sector and requiring a lot more reporting. There's also some potential limits that regulators could place on some of these largest banks. But as we've seen it over the past 10 years, you know, banks are growing much faster than the rate of GDP, 7 times faster since the financial crisis, than the rate of GDP. So we're going to continue to see banks growing. It's just a matter of how regulators handle that growth in the future, and then in terms of what they do in the event of a future crisis.
Well, can you talk a bit about what changes are coming? Because there's talk about limiting proprietary trading, that's in the works, and down payments for home buyers being larger, that sort of thing?
Yep. There's a lot of changes like that, but some of the main assistance or tools that the regulators will have in the event of a future crisis relates to capital and leverage requirements, like you mentioned. A lot of those are going to be finalized for these systemically risky institutions, these large, there's 35 bank holding companies that qualify as a systemically risky bank, and all of those are going to have to hold additional capital. A lot of these regulations are being finalized in the third and fourth quarter of this year. We'll also have orderly liquidation plans in place where the FDIC will go in and look at bank holding companies and non-bank financials and be able to wind them down in the event of a future crisis using sort of not the bankruptcy code, but their own ways of winding down these firms, very similar to what they do with deposit taking institutions now using FDIC insurance.
And again, Katie North is Senior Finance Policy Analyst for Bloomberg Government. Eric Talley is Professor and Gilbert Foundation Chair in Law, Business and the Economy at UC Berkeley School of Law at Bolt Hall. And Professor Talley, the privately traded derivatives, we're told, are much safer and more efficient, but there's still a $600 trillion market that really hasn't been cleaned up at all.
Well, this is a huge market, and it, by many accounts, is one of the huge catalysts for the financial meltdown in 2008 and 2009. You know, the effort is, as Katie said, is ongoing to try to regulate various aspects of derivatives and swap trading. In particular, there are initiatives in place to try to encourage a clearinghouse through which these swaps might be traded. Another controversial initiative would regulate the types of securities that can be used as collateral, essentially safe money, for the purposes of trying to ensure cabin the risk of these sorts of swaps. That's proven to be quite controversial because the most recent proposal would limit that collateral to cash and U.S. treasuries. A lot of this stuff was supposed to go live again last week, got delayed, kicked down the road another 6 months over the last month or so.
Well, we're hearing from Barney Frank that the Republicans are starving the regulators, and they not only don't have the money to do what needs to be done, but there's a lot of fight going on in Capitol Hill against these regulations.
Well, one of the most interesting things about Dodd-Frank, and it's probably true about most types of financial reform, is that, you know, when Congress promulgates these acts, there's a lot of fact-finding that has to be done to go into sort of filling out the details. And therefore, Congress almost necessarily has to kick the can down the road to the various regulatory entities. Those regulatory entities themselves haven't remained stable. Static. There's been a lot of rearranging of the deck chairs in terms of the regulatory landscape that's been going on. And because of that, Republicans in Congress who have confirmation power, for instance, for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, can credibly, at least currently, say, well, we're not going to move forward on this and we're going to filibuster the appointment.
The delays just keep going on.
Yeah, the CFPB, in order to actually start enforcing some of the regulations it's been charged with, needs to have a director in place. They still don't have a director in place.
Well, I've seen a lot of public anger as a result of this. I mean, when you consider the fact that there was a bailout and now all this delay is going on in these regulations. On the other hand, there's going to be a whistleblowing protection rule next month, and is the expectation that that will bring certain changes that are needed?
Well, you know, this is a fairly new initiative within securities law. It does sort of mimic something that was present in tax law and some federal procurement laws before. But this is essentially a proposal that has actually gone into final rules in which a whistleblower inside a firm, if it reports to the SEC impropriety that results in a fine or penalty for violation of securities laws, would allow that whistleblower to collect between 10% and 30% of amounts collected over $1 million. This has been very controversial. It's likely to end up sort of changing the landscape a little bit. There's a live and ongoing enterprise in trying to figure out whether it's going to change it for the positive or the negative. Some critics of the whistleblower protection or the whistleblower bounty system have said, you know, our internal compliance programs are going to get subverted by this. We're trying to do the right thing. We want people to report internally, but this is going to sort of dangle a carrot for them not to report internally, but to go out to the SEC. So it's a very kind of complicated landscape, and this one, I think, has gotten a lot of attention within securities regulation.
It's also been a lot of attention given to the fact that, the global needs go far beyond Dodd-Frank.
Oh, undoubtedly, the global needs go beyond Dodd-Frank, and a lot of the institutions here find themselves competing with, banks that aren't regulated, at least principally by Dodd-Frank. And so, you know, for instance, we were talking about swap regulation earlier, and the types of collateral that would be necessary for essentially insuring these sorts of swap contracts. It's not clear that foreign banks are going to be subject to the same sorts of regulations. And so not only is there a challenge of trying to figure out how do we get it right domestically, but we also then have to factor in, well, if we think we've got it right domestically, but the rest of the world hasn't gotten it right, are we going to lose a competitive advantage against them? And so this becomes a very, very sort of complicating factor within trying to regulate various firms which are global, which compete internationally and compete with international competitors.
Should we make a lot of the fact that MetLife sold off their bank unit because of Dodd-Frank?
Well, I think these things sort of happen all the time. And as Katie had mentioned, you know, this has been, last 3 years has been essentially the eBay of bank sales. So it's definitely true that that some firms, you know, want to try to figure out how they would situate themselves to avoid various types of regulatory oversight. You know, the banking industry is going to survive this. The banking industry is probably going to change as Dodd-Frank and the mandates of Dodd-Frank start to take more shape. These things happen all the time. I wouldn't make too much of it.
Again, we're talking Eric Talley, UC Berkeley School of Law, Baltal, and he's an economist as well as an attorney. Debt ceiling negotiations, could that further weaken Dodd-Frank?
You know, I think so. I mean, there are a couple things that are going on with debt ceiling negotiations. Right now, we're in a stare down. I think most people think that they're going to reach an 11th hour deal, but the terms of that deal are going to be difficult to predict, or certainly are difficult to predict right now. The Republicans have drawn the line in the sand saying, listen, we want to cut expenditures and cut them dramatically. Some of those expenditures are the very expenditures that were destined to be poured into some of these new bureaus and regulatory entities. And this is in undoubtedly part and parcel with the enterprise of trying to figure out, well, what's the appropriate size of government? Where should we be spending governmental capital?
And Katie North, when Barney Frank says that the Republicans will chip away at crucial components of the law, including the new derivatives rules and the tighter lending standards, just how serious a warning is that from your perspective?
Well, like I said, there haven't been very many legislative initiatives that have actually seen House floor or Senate floor action on this. But the real concern coming from Barney Frank is that through the appropriations process and the budgetary process, that Republicans might defund or underfund some of the agencies working on all of these hundreds of new rules, particularly those two agencies, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and the Securities and Exchange Commission, which are working on those very important rules related to over-the-counter derivatives.
You should mention, by the way, that both Christopher Dodd and Barney Frank have been, well, criticized for the fact that they encourage and permitted Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae to extend mortgage loans to those who had poor credit and little down payments. And, of course, Frank had an intervention on behalf of a friend who was employed at Fannie Mae and the famous countrywide VIP story about the loan that was made by Senator Dodd as a preferential loan has also played into, unfortunately, the politics as they continue to go along. We wanted to bring another voice into this, and that's Scott Talbot, who is Senior Vice President for Government Affairs with Financial Services Roundtable. They represent the financial industry. And Scott Talbot, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Nice to be here, Michael.
Let's begin by talking about what, I mean, they've been talking about the reform of reform coming from Wall Street and about $52 million spent just in the last 3 months lobbying. What are we trying to see other than maybe delaying some of these regulations?
Well, I think that the industry's opposition to Dodd-Frank has been overblown. We're not opposed to a lot of what Dodd-Frank is about. In fact, what we're trying to do with that money spent is to shape the regulations to ensure that we have the most effective solution. If you look across the spectrum, you can overregulate an institution and you can underregulate it. And clearly, in the past, the regulators were not as modern as they should have been. And so Dodd-Frank did a lot to modernize the regulatory structure, which we support. But at the same time, you can overregulate and stifle creativity, innovation, and the free flow of capital. And so that's what we're worried about. And so we're working to ensure that Dodd-Frank is implemented in the most effective manner to balance the needs of strengthening our system, protecting consumers, and at the same time allowing for the free flow of capital and ideas so we don't have an overburden.
I'm sure you saw the piece in the New York Times about a major lobbyist from your group.
It was my boss.
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Steve Bartlett.
And the letters that were in response to that profile were so scathing. I mean, essentially they were saying, look, these guys got a bailout, and now all they want to do is change these rules. So when you say that's been overblown, I mean, the article pointed out that there really has been a lot of lobbying to limit fees that banks charge retailers on debt card purchases and caps on things and executive compensation disclosure, credit rating guidelines. These are the sorts of things that get people very angry.
Well, a couple things. One, the language relating to debit card fees had nothing to do with the financial crisis. That was I would characterize it as an opportunistic piece of provision that was included in it. It had nothing to do with the crisis. Debit cards didn't have anything to do with the financial crisis. So we did work to try and change that, and it amounted to government price controls from a philosophical basis. We were working on changing that. And as far as credit rating agencies, we don't have a position necessarily on the credit rating agencies. But I think what a couple people I would point out is, one, you know, banks made mistakes, and we've apologized to a large extent for those, and we're working to make it right. But the banking system is much stronger now. We have higher capital, stronger liquidity and leverage ratios. We have whistleblower programs, say on pay. We've ended or changed or modified a lot of the riskier activities, derivatives, and the like. We have the new Consumer Protection Bureau. And so the system is much stronger. And going forward, we have new requirements for living wills and ordered liquidation authority. And to help strengthen our system. And so a lot has been done to make the system better. And what we're talking about, as I said, is making the rules to implement Dodd-Frank the most effective.
And at this point, you're optimistic that we're going to move ahead and we're going to see more regulations that will make things more effective?
I am. I think that we do have some delays in the regulations and to writing them, but these are highly complex and they're interconnected. And so a change on one affects the rest of the markets. So I'd rather take the time to get it done right. We're not arguing for a delay. We're not asking for a delay for the most part. But what we're saying is take the time to get it right. I'd rather see a good rule that takes a little bit longer than a rule that is rushed and gets things wrong.
Let me get your take on this, Eric Talley, because there's a lot of defensiveness on Wall Street, and there's been a lot of attacking of Wall Street, not only for their culpability with respect to the meltdown, but for their attempt to, well, create obstacles in terms of Dodd-Frank and its implementation. And now we're hearing from Eric Talley that they want to move ahead. They want Scott Talbot, they want to make things more efficient.
Well, I have no doubt that the banking industry also wants to see good laws. I think the question of getting it done right is something that's a highly debatable topic. And so I think the banking industry is going to have its view. I think consumer advocacy groups are going to have their view. I think professional regulators are going to have their view. And one of the
and by the way, we'll hear from a consumer advocate later on in the program. Yeah.
And so one of the things that makes this a difficult landscape is the fact that in some ways this isn't even a well-specified problem. You know, there are so many changes that are in play right now that it's almost impossible to predict exactly how they're going to lay out. For instance, the General Accounting Office, of the federal government issued a report in June, talking about the implementation of the Volcker Rule, right, the prohibition on proprietary trading. of banks and financial institutions, and said, look, it's going to be really difficult to define even what proprietary trading is, as opposed to trading for customer accounts, ordinary risk management practices, and so forth. And so the question then whether it becomes, so daunting that that we end up in a type of an analysis paralysis governmentally, and we don't do anything at the end of the day. I have little doubt that there are some people that would prefer that to be the case, and I'm not suggesting Mr. Talbot is one of those individuals, and I don't think he is. But this is a highly complicated environment, both analytically and politically.
On the other hand, I think Katie North, one has to take account for the fact that accounting has become more transparent. There's more off-balance sheet assets that are pretty much gone, and some banks are selling some of these risky units, as I mentioned earlier, as in the case of MetLife.
Certainly. You know, MetLife isn't the only one. There's Barclays and several other firms who have made announcements that they're going to change their internal structure so that they maybe aren't classified as a bank holding company any longer, or sell off their U.S.-based operations in the case of Barclays so that these new capital requirements and things won't come into play for them at this time. We've seen that from a lot of different firms. And in fact, 9 of those 35 U.S. bank holding companies that I mentioned are actually foreign-owned banks. And, you know, there's a lot being discussed globally as to how all of this is being coordinated. And there's not a whole lot of assurance at this point that, you know, as we mentioned earlier, that all of these regulations will come online at the same time and that they might not necessarily work together or come, you know, have the same sort of effect.
What about what I'm reading as far as the residential lenders who talk about these regulations not only being burdensome but being a kind of octopus with respect to income restrictions? And they say they're concerned that there will be, that the banks will raise the interest rates, among other things.
You know, there's going to be a lot of discussion, I think, throughout the rest of the year. After some of these regulations start coming on board, Congress may turn their attention more to GSE reform and looking at Fannie and Freddie and some of the regulations regarding housing. And we may see more and more discussion and oversight on this issue. But, you know, it's possible that the 30-year mortgage might not look the same once Congress gets through with some of this regulation. And we've already seen that it's much harder to do a refinance. It's much harder at this point to get that standard mortgage that people are used to. And if further reforms are made to Fannie and Freddie, that, you know, there's a potential that could go away as well.
And Scott Talbot, before we say goodbye to you, what about all this criticism that's saying the financial industry is buying off Washington and killing reform? What do you say in succinctly?
I think that's wrong. That's not our goal at all, and that's not what we're doing. Not anyone could do that. Our goal is to strengthen the system, whether it's mortgage lending, whether it's consumer protections, whether it's executive comp, whether it's activities, capital. We're making a stronger system that can help this economy get out of the recession or strengthen itself, and so people can go on and have the money they need to live their everyday lives. That's what we're all about.
Scott Talbot, we thank you for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you.
Scott Talbot, again, a Senior Vice President for Government Affairs with the Financial Services Roundtable. They represent the financial industry. As I said, we'll hear from a consumer policy analyst as well when we come back. But we want to hear from you. If you have some thoughts you'd like to put into this conversation or if you have some responses to what you've heard so far, we welcome your phone calls. You can join us now toll-free at 866-733-6786. Again, the toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, is 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. Continue talking with Katie North, Senior Finance Policy Analyst for Bloomberg Government, and Eric Talley, Professor and Gilbert Foundation Chair in Law, Business, and the Economy at UC Berkeley School of Law at Bolt Hall. And we'll also hear from you, our listeners. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Lax investment regulations and bad home loans are blamed for sparking the nation's deepest recession in decades. And in response, on July 21st, 2010, almost 1 year ago, we saw the biggest piece of financial reform legislation in this nation's history. It was introduced, that legislation, by lawmakers Barney Frank, Chris Dodd, and others, as the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. And the goal was to keep average American consumers safe. 1 year later, the act is under legislative attack, and some are questioning whether the legislation has indeed accomplished its goals. We spoke earlier with Scott Talbot, Senior Vice President for Government Affairs with Financial Services Roundtable, a group representing the financial industry. Our guests for the hour include Eric Talley, Professor and Gilbert Foundation Chair in Law, Business, and the Economy at UC Berkeley School of Law at Bolt Hall, and Katie North, who is Senior Finance Policy Analyst for Bloomberg Government. We want to bring you in, and in fact, if you have something you'd like to contribute, your emails are welcome, forum@kqed.org, or you can post questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or join us by phone at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. And before we go to calls and emails, I want to bring Lisa Donner into this. She's an executive director of the Americans for Financial Reform. They are a consumer advocacy group and joins us this morning from the nation's capital. Lisa Donner, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Well, are consumers better off, or to what degree are they better off as a result of Dodd-Frank?
Well, so this is a big law, as you said, and a lot of the things that it requires and puts into place have not happened yet, because they were written to take a minute to have the rules right. But consumers, but the regulators are sort of plugging ahead with doing the work that needs to be done to put this law into effect. And the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, for example, which was a major accomplishment for the public interest in this law, the first time we will have a federal agency with the sole job of making sure that the financial marketplace is safe for consumers, opened its doors last week on Thursday, and is in fact set to make a big difference for consumers.
Now, there's already a political battle that is in the works there, because President Obama's nominated Attorney General from Ohio, Richard Cordray, and as director of that bureau, and that's going to be a battle again with Republicans in Congress. They vow to block any nominee unless the agency's power is curbed.
No, that's right. The Consumer Bureau, immensely important and positioned to make a tremendous difference in terms of consumers' lives, but also under attack, as it has been from the beginning. Last week, the House passed a bill that would essentially cripple the Bureau, subject to political manipulation, make the existing failed regulators able to overturn its decisions, essentially, sort of return us to the status quo that brought us the financial crisis, effectively. And the Senate, 44 Senate Republicans have signed a letter saying unless changes like that to really cripple the Bureau are put into place, they won't consider any nominee. So there is going to be a fight to make sure that this Bureau really is able to move ahead in the way that it needs to.
Well, what would you say to what we just heard from Scott Talbot, representing the Financial Services Roundtable, that is the financial industry, that financial industry is not necessarily fighting. I mean, they certainly are putting a lot of money into lobbying, but he's saying they want to see, you know, effective rules for consumers.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. As you said, though, there's a lot of money going into lobbying, pretty much as much in the first quarter of this year they're on the same pace on spending in the first quarter this year, essentially, as they were last year and the year before when Dodd-Frank was being debated in Congress. So there is a lot of money being spent by the trade associations, by individual business interests, by the chamber on their behalf, and we are seeing the impact of that in, as I said, for example, the fact that 44 Senate Republicans saying they refuse to consider a nominee on the non-consumer side, but also of tremendous public import. Another really big accomplishment of Dodd-Frank was the creation of more transparency and accountability in the derivatives market, another key cause of the financial crisis. Among the biggest threats to the progress that was made in Dodd-Frank, there is an effort to defund the CFTC. This is the tiny little agency that now has a market seven times as large as ever before to regulate. unless the CFTC is able to do its job, this major victory of shining some light on requiring accountability, no gambling without some money to back up that gambling in the derivatives markets, will be a dead letter.
Well, I had said earlier that Congressman Frank said that the GOP, that is the Republicans, are not only trying to starve the regulators, that is the CFTC, but the SEC as well. Is that apt phrasing on his part?
Yes, the budget cuts to the SEC are not quite as draconian, but similarly, the SEC has got a bunch of new jobs to do under Dodd-Frank in overseeing credit rating agencies and establishing a new Office of Investor Protection in regulating its piece of these giant derivatives markets. And yes, they are trying to deprive it of the funding that it needs to do that job.
Yeah, Lisa Donner's with us.
Zero impact on the budget, by the way.
Yeah. Lisa Donner with us on the line, Executive Director of Americans for Financial Reform. Let me get this caller on who I think we'd like a response from you on, Lisa Donner. This is Lee from Santa Rosa. Lee, welcome.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay, thank you.
Good, how are you?
I see a problem in, well, first off, I've been a commercial mortgage broker for 35 years, and we do about 20% of our portfolio in home loans funded by private investors. So we're not in the what Frank and Barney or Frank and Dodd intended to regulate. However, it does. The bill says that you shall not make a loan to anyone who cannot afford to make payments. Well, that all sounds wonderful, except that there are tens of thousands of people out there for one reason or another who need a loan, and they're not looking for a government-insured loan. They're looking for a loan from their neighbor down the street. And most of the people who've been doing those loans have completely, like my company, completely withdrawn from that market because of the over-regulation.
Let me hear from Lisa Donner on...
They're completely out in the market.
Yeah, Lee, I think we get your point, and I'd like to hear what Ms. Donner has to say. Lisa Donner?
Sure, thanks for the question. You know, I think it's startlingly clear that the fact that there was a market, not just or not mostly in government-insured loans, but in private, in securitized loans, that included a lot of loans that people obviously could not afford to repay, and that didn't used to be illegal, was a fundamental source, actually, of the financial crisis. That turned out to be devastating to individual borrowers, and it turned out to be devastating to our whole economy. So I think it was actually a very important piece of progress in Dodd-Frank that for the first time became illegal. It's actually pretty shocking to many people that wasn't illegal in the past. The thought that people have exited that market because of overregulation, frankly, that regulation hasn't gone into effect yet. So nobody's exited because of the reason people have exited that market is because right now that market, lending in that market, destroyed the economy, and there's huge uncertainty in the financial markets, in the funding markets behind those loans, partially because of problems down the line, partially because in addition to being badly underwritten loans, many of those loans were packaged into securities in violation of the securities laws and in violation of the tax laws, and the investors who provided for that funding, the funding for those loans, are not doing that now because they don't see how it makes sense.
Let me thank the caller and get some response from you, Lisa Donner, to a couple of emails here. This is Doug from Oakland, who says, given what we know now about too big to fail and unbridled speculation, was it wise to dismantle Glass-Steagall?
Well, in my view and in AFR's view, it wasn't particularly wise to dismantle Glass-Steagall. It's a good question, and the level of risk-taking and the level of interconnectedness and concentration that has been produced in the financial markets were, as the writer said, tremendously dangerous. The Dodd-Frank does not restore Glass-Steagall. It does take some steps in that direction that are useful, and it will be very important going forward to really pay attention to how those are implemented, how those rules are written, and what the regulators do with the new authority that they have. Do they really use that authority to be tough about risk, about excessive risk-taking, to be tough about excessive interconnectedness? Now, there are some places where the Dodd-Frank has specific provisions and some stuff where it says regulators note that you are now empowered, and it will be very important to keep up the public pressure and the public questions, so that as the memory of this crisis starts to fade, not that it's in danger of fading for most of us who are still suffering the consequences, but you fear that it fades for the bankers who are doing well again, we keep asking questions about that. The Volcker Rule, which prohibits proprietary trading as well as conflicts of interest, was a sort of mini Glass-Steagall step, and we are still waiting to see the final rules on that very important Dodd-Frank provision.
One other question, Lisa Donner, is from Bill, who says, as we know, derivatives can have positive uses, but the bottom line is that they performed an insidious and explosive function in the mortgage market. Without fundamental regulation in the derivatives market, it's only a matter of time before another crisis.
I think that's absolutely correct, and I think making change in the derivatives market was one place that it was very, very hard fought in Dodd-Frank. Huge opposition to these changes by the giant industry players. It's five Wall Street megabanks who dominate the money-making in this industry. They were hugely opposed to these changes, and they are continuing to fight off, you know, their effective implementation. But the CFTC and the SEC are sort of plugging ahead on writing these rules. This is where the funding question comes back in again. They are plugging ahead on writing these rules, not perfectly, but in the spirit of the law. If they're not adequately funded, though, there will be no way to enforce those rules. So, really, I urge everybody to be attentive to that and to hold folks in Congress accountable for that decision.
Since you mentioned funding of CFTC and SEC, I want to go back to Eric Talley, Professor Eric Talley, here with us in studio. You were saying there's been some activity recently at the SEC that perhaps the public may want to know about?
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things about Dodd-Frank is that it empowers the SEC to roll out a pretty large laundry list of different types of corporate governance reforms. And in fact, the SEC was already partway down that path when Dodd-Frank was promulgated and passed. One thing that the SEC was in the middle of doing was adopting new rules that would grant various block shareholders rights to nominate new directors to the slate of directors who were to be elected into office. And believe it or not, this is not a power that a single block shareholder necessarily has right now. She or he or it could bargain for it, but wouldn't necessarily have it. The SEC actually promulgated that rule at about the same time that Dodd-Frank was being finalized in legislation, and it was challenged in court. And about 10 days ago, that challenge was upheld, and the SEC's rule change was overturned as being arbitrary and capricious and without factual basis. And the interesting thing about that is that that's not the only recent SEC rule change dealing with securities market or corporate governance that has been challenged successfully on these very grounds. And it may, and in fact, this was a provision that was inside Dodd-Frank. It was essentially, you know, the Congress giving its imprimatur for the SEC to go forward with this rule. It raises the possibility that if the SEC wants to go back to the drawing board with this rule or any of its other dozens and dozens of rule-changing mandates that it's currently under, it's probably going to have to spend a little bit more money doing the background cost-benefit analysis than it did with this proxy access rule. And so a lot of people are a little bit worried from the SEC's perspective that, you know, it hasn't seen the kind of increase in budget that you would need actually to do all of these studies if the same sort of challenge were to have legs on all these other grounds.
Again, Eric Talley is professor and Gilbert Foundation chair in law, business, and the economy at UC Berkeley School of Law. And Matt is joining us from the city. Matt, you're on. Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
I was wondering, you know, I've been listening to the program, and it's a great program. I've been listening to it for several years now. I own a mortgage bank in San Francisco. We did several billion dollars worth of lending over the last several years. We have zero defaults in our portfolio, and we've been in business since 2004 and lend a tremendous amount of money out into the economy and employ a tremendous amount of people. We've hired several people this year. The biggest problem that I see right now is that the regulations, the unintended consequences of the regulations and the Dodd-Frank bill are just massive, and they are going to absolutely have a huge impact on our economy and on the recovery It's being felt dramatically right now. And I take issue with your guest saying that it's the banks are not interested in regulation, that we're trying to lobby away any kind of regulation. I think that that's completely wrong. I think most of the bad actors that were in the environment during the crash are gone now. And now these regulations that are coming through are extremely damaging to our economy to recover. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be enacted. I'm just saying, you have to be careful of the unintended consequences. I think that I'd like to hear a comment about that.
Well, I'd like to hear from Lisa Diner in response to your remarks and observations there. I think he's saying maybe something is being paved with good intentions here, maybe the road to wherever. Lisa Diner.
Sure. The interesting thing about that is that that's exactly the argument that we heard again and again and again in the 10 years leading up to the crisis. Every time that we attempted to regulate the most abusive mortgage practices, for example, those practices which turned out, again, to be, there is broad agreement. Those mortgage practices that turned out to be at the root or one of the roots of this financial crisis, when we tried to regulate them before the crisis, we were told, no, there'll be unintended consequences. You'll hurt the very people you're trying to help. And that, coupled with the money, that argument in the mouths of people who were spending a lot of money on politics and on lobbying, managed to forestall and prevent the passage of law. And it managed to prevent the Federal Reserve Board, which could have taken action to prevent some of these practices from taking action. So I think it would be very dangerous to allow sort of general arguments about unintended consequences, especially when they're deployed now. And as I said at the beginning, we haven't actually seen the new rules go into effect yet. So it seems a little speculative to talk about how deeply dangerous they're going to be. Folks put together a report.
Is there a comment that I can make back to that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Number one, your answer basically is let's regulate more because regulation didn't work in the past. That's number one. Number two is, are you working in the mortgage industry right now? Do you know what you're talking about? Did you actually work in the industry ever? I don't mean to be acrimonious, but saying that that's the typical argument is unintended consequences, and then dismissing it as just some party line. This isn't some kind of party line. Go out and speak to anybody. Go speak to a real estate agent.
Right, Matt, let me get again a response from Lisa Diner, because you're saying that she really can't understand this from the outside, and I'd like to hear what she has to say to that.
I've never worked in the mortgage industry, but I have spent a great deal of time looking at the subprime mortgage industry and working on efforts to regulate and to change the law in relation to it. So I feel like I do actually understand the market pretty well. I've heard and seen those quotes saying there will be unintended consequences, so you must not regulate, just as I have heard and seen, as we all have, what terrifying damage was done by loans being made, for example, that borrowers couldn't afford to repay, by loans being made on the basis of compensation systems that rewarded brokers or mortgage employees more for putting people in a higher cost loan than the best they could afford, increasing the risk to the system. So I think the evidence is pretty clear, and I actually think the evidence also is pretty clear that the public agrees with me about this, that most people believe that we actually do need a system of adequate financial regulation. There were structural problems with the system in the past. It wasn't anybody's job. It wasn't anybody's first priority to be looking out for and making sure that the marketplace worked fairly. And that, in the end, ought to actually be better, not just for consumers, but for market players who want to compete on the basis of having a good product, having a loan that works for people and is fair and is at a good price, rather than being undercut by people who are willing to most aggressively sell the most abusive parkas, having sort of a race to the bottom. I think that's part of what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to set up a marketplace where customers can see prices and risks up front and make comparisons, in which people can't build a business model around deception or abusive practices, and it works for both consumers and for responsible market participants, from responsible lenders.
I want to thank Matt for his call, and thank you, Lisa Donner. Lisa Donner, again, Executive Director of Americans for Financial Reform, a consumer advocacy group. Appreciate your being with us. Thank you. And we'll get another caller on here, and that's Eric. You're on from Palo Alto. Good morning.
Hi. It seems like what we're getting here is the worst of all possible worlds. I mean, the people who are arguing against this regulation are absolutely right that it's too much regulation and too much uncertainty. And then the people who are arguing that it's not enough are correct as well. It ignores incentives. So there are four or five things that could be done immediately that establish proper incentives and don't create big new bureaucracy. So the first is reinstate Glass-Steagall exactly as it was, with exactly the same bureaucracy it had before it was repealed. Second, institute a duck test for insurance. If it walks like insurance, has a payout structure that looks like insurance, it's insurance, and it is subject to the counterparty risk regulations that we have with insurance. That bureaucracy exists. Third, proportional reserve requirements. So the bigger you are, the bigger the reserve, and if you're a foreign bank, you're measured on the same sense of bigness as an American bank. And finally, you can't, if you broker a loan, you have to participate in the risk of the loan. And that law exists in the UK, and we could just copy it essentially word for word from the UK. And that basically gets rid of all the bad incentives that were created by the deregulation without having to play this game of regulatory whack-a-mole that we heard getting debated back and forth between the mortgage broker and the consumer advocate. So,
Eric, appreciate your suggestions and want to hear from Katie North on response to them. Katie North?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of things that, you know, you have stakeholders on each side of each of these issues battling and discussing, you know, the pros and cons of the regulations as they stand. You know, one example of that is the provisions on living wills. A few months ago, the FDIC and the Fed released this proposal to mandate that all firms, foreign and domestic, doing business in the U.S., create a funeral plan for themselves in the event that another crisis happens. And this is using the bankruptcy code to show regulators how they would sell off various subsidiaries, wind down, and not affect the rest of the financial system. Now, when the regulators looked at that, they said this is going to require over 12,000 man hours to complete these living wills on average. You know, that's a team of 20 people working 4 months at a minimum, if you look at man hours alone, to do this. Of course, these large interconnected firms with operations globally all over the planet, with subsidiaries all over, they're going to have to identify each of their counterparties, each of the areas where they have credit risk exposure to any other firm that could be systemically significant. It's a very huge undertaking. And so you can see on one side of the coin how producing these living will plans can be extremely valuable information for regulators as they seek to potentially wind down some of these banks in the event of a future crisis. But you can also see the other side of the coin of that, where banks are going to have to put a huge cost and a huge time sink into creating these plans. And, you know, maybe they're not as focused on, you know, in their compliance departments on some other aspects of their day-to-day business.
Let me go to a couple of email questions about banks. In fact, a very direct question from a listener named Colin, Katie North, who says, if all this regulation has made the banking system stronger, then why is lending still so horribly low?
You know, that's a big question for the banks is when will lending pick up? Part of that has to do with the economy and how the economy is doing. But banks are certainly weighing these compliance costs, and that factors into how they do business. We've already talked a little bit about the business changes going on within the markets. You know, a lot of announcements being made of some of the firms are taking advantage of buying firms that or subsidiaries of firms that are doing business in the U.S. You know, Capital One Financial announced that they might purchase ING's deposit-taking business, and that's a foreign-based entity. And then, you know, Barclays is going to spin off maybe some of their U.S. operations in order to not have to deal with the capital requirements in Dodd-Frank. So companies are taking the opportunity in both directions. You know, sometimes they're wanting to get out of it all altogether and not deal with the regulation, but in some cases they're working with the regulation and maybe making a business opportunity out of it.
Well, here's a listener named Dwayne who says, regulations might be burdensome to banks. My goodness, how did banks ever survive after 1930? Oh, that's right. They were bailed out by taxpayers. Fast forward 60 years when the banks managed to rid themselves of onerous regulations. Bye-bye, Glass-Steagall, only to be bailed out again by taxpayers. Yet they're still pleading the American public to trust their judgment. How stupid can we Americans be? Banks should be broken up to reduce systemic risk and return to sound regulation. Here's another listener. Question, perhaps, Eric Talley, for you. Mike says, Wall Street, which makes millions on trading derivatives, which are really unrateable, wants them to continue in circulation. Are there any regs that would limit circulation so that such questionable securities be only in portfolios of institutions with no fiduciary duties to the larger American public and not allowed in portfolios of Fed Reserve banks and FDIC insured institutions?
Well, part of Dodd-Frank in process is actually dedicated to trying to define what constitutes a sophisticated investor, and there's sort of a moving target on what that's going to be. You know, I guess part of the deal here is not just this question of whether a security is speculative or not, but also, and this goes back to a couple of the earlier callers' comments, you know, one of the difficult things about particularly derivative securities and swaps, credit default swaps, and collateralized debt obligations is that you know, you and I, Warren, could get into a trade of one of these swaps, and we do it sort of informally on an over the counter basis. It becomes really difficult once you start aggregating all those things, and they don't look and walk and talk a lot like each other, to back out or cancel out of those trades, other than to just make more of them. And so one of the proposals, which, you know, I think has got at least some theoretical grounding, is to say, look, if we're going to get into these sorts of trades, at least we're going to be encouraged to try to do them through a centralized clearinghouse, the way that options are generally traded as well, in a way that would allow people to sort of understand what's out there, what its risk attributes are, and provide a mechanism for actually getting out of a deal to reverse course it. And you know, that was, you know, the lack of transparency in that market, I think a lot of people thought, was one of the big problems in the fall of 2008, is we really didn't even have a great idea how much of this stuff was out there and what its overall risk attributes are. You know, I for one sort of think that you know, one of the big dangers, I think, with the current sort of reform movement, and here I think I am sympathetic to critics, is that, you know, we tend to be, you know, overly pessimistic about what some types of financial-driven products can do.
Well, we've got another year of Dodd-Frank up ahead, and we'll continue to watch what's happening. Certainly more regulations, more attempted regulations at any rate in the year to come, and we will be watching to see what will come down the pike. I want to thank Eric Talley from UC Berkeley School of Law, Bolt Hall, and Katie North from Bloomberg Government. Also, Lisa Donner from the Americans for Financial Reform and Scott Talbot from the Financial Services Roundtable. Thank you, our listeners, and thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Amy Machado. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.